Resource Committee together for February 2nd. Committee, I think today we're going to have an informational hearing on general ag issues. It's kind of ag day. Every day is ag day for many of us. And we're going to talk about animal health issues, emergency response plans, food safety, Bio-Oregon, we're going to have an update, Brand Oregon. So kind of a general consensus of what we're doing in the ag community and what the Department of Ag is doing. And I promise to speak louder, Representative. Please let me know if you don't hear me.
It's my advancing age and failing you.
No, I think I sometimes speak softly, but I do carry a big stick.
Thank you.
I've heard that somewhere. Isn't that? Yes. So we'll start with the informational, I'll open an informational hearing. Meeting, I probably already did that. Don't need to do that. Katie Koba, anybody you want to bring up with you? Oh, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And as the Chair mentioned, we've got a number of issues to go over with you this morning in a little more detail than we were able to last week when we were before you. So thank you very much for the opportunity to come back. And I'm sure we'll be before you yet again before the session is out. What I'd like to do this morning is we've got a number of topics and a number of different staff people that will address those topics. And we're going to start out talking about animal health issues. And this obviously became a very high-profile issue during our current interim with the discovery of the single incident of BSE in the United States in the state of Washington. A little over a year ago, the cow that stole Christmas of 2003. And our agency got very involved in that effort and continues to be involved in the efforts around how we're handling BSE and the development of a national livestock identification system. But there are other animal diseases which we deal with on a continual basis. And I think if you remember one of the comments that I made last week to this committee, we expect animal diseases and plant diseases, which we will not talk about today, to continue to be a growing area of concern for the industry with the continued involvement in terms of global trade. And global trade brings many good things, but it also, with the additional movement of products, does present the threat of diseases. So this morning we're going to talk about a number of infectious diseases that we here in Oregon are particularly concerned about, and as well as what we're doing in terms of emergency response preparedness, making sure that our staff and the industry is prepared to deal with any kind of outbreak that might arrive in Oregon. Obviously, our number one goal is to keep diseases out, but secondly, we do need to be prepared to respond in case we identify disease. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Don Hansen, who is the state's veterinarian and housed in the Department of Agriculture, and he is going to give you a more learned view on animal diseases this morning.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the welcome. I'm Don Hansen, state veterinarian from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and it's my pleasure to be here on an official basis. I've been here before you and before this committee unofficially at other times when I was extension veterinarian and silently in November, but now I have the opportunity to open my mouth, hopefully intelligently. Beginning with the BSE issue, I just remind everyone, I think you probably as a group know pretty much what's happening, but just as an update, we'll just mention the fact that the border closed with the first incident, the border, Canadian border, with the first incident in Canada in May of 2003, but boneless meat materials were allowed and continue to be allowed to move across the border under special grant and special preparations. And those are meat from cattle less than 30 months of age and some lamb product, if it's, I have not been able to see that it was actually moved, but they could move lamb product, meat products. And currently, I was chasing down the tonnage, but and I have an unofficial number of 100,000 plus metric tons during the year 2004 and could not get USDA confirmation on that number, so don't hold me to it, but it's going to be something close. There were 14,000 metric tons in a couple weeks in December, so it wouldn't be hard to make that 100,000. So that's in one scenario. In response to our Canadian cow, and I prefer to think about her as a Canadian cow that accidentally or on purpose got sent to the United States. The United States, as you recall, adopted a number of additional prevention measures. Number one, not accepting non-ambulatory cows into the food chain, period. Pulling out specific or specified risk materials from animals, particularly over 30 months of age. So they took, they're saying, for cows and bulls, animals over 30 months of age, the spinal column, spinal cord, and all of those materials cannot enter the human food chain. Plus, tonsils and small intestine from all animals, all cattle. So those are set in motion. Then prohibiting central nervous tissue from being in advanced meat recovery systems, and suspect holding, learning a lesson from Christmas cow. If we have an animal that's suspect, then all of that material is held out of the human food chain until it's confirmed one way or the other. So that was the other rule that was put in place. And then FDA, in around the same time period, this is November through before our Christmas cow, and then right after the first of the year in 2004, FDA had some other bans that they put in place or proposed. They have not acted on these yet, but you have to know that they're still in play and may be acted on. One is to prohibit blood and blood products from entering the food chain. Poultry litter prohibited from ruminant feeds. Plate waste prohibited from ruminant feeds. And feed mills being held to a higher standard of keeping their products completely separated from ruminant and non-ruminant. Those are proposed rules that they're looking at and haven't addressed them, haven't come up with a final. It's still no comment after the comment period. Then, as you know, November 2003, USDA proposed a minimum risk final rule. And we heard just recently that they finished the comment period and now the final rule is in place to be enacted March 7th. That is depending on Senate action, congressional action, and judicial actions that are, as you know, are at play right now with RCAF and a number of other organizations trying to stop this rule from coming into place. But just reminding us, the final rule had to do with the United States attempting to define a minimum risk BSE country. The international standards are there to do that. It's just a grade. Minimum risk is not a grade that's that OIE, that is the Organization of International Epizootics, is accepting. So the United States, in a sense, is putting that up and saying, all right, if we have a prevalence of BSE in that country of less than 2 per million, and they have a ruminant feed protein feed ban in place, and they do good case surveillance, and have a banning and importation of ruminant products, then that country could be a BSE country, and that fits Canada. Canada is working. So that's what they're proposing. Under that proposed rule, they would allow live animal imports to occur, and that would be animals less than 30 months of age could come in a sealed truck directly to a harvest facility or in a truck to a federally designated feedlot, then to a slaughter facility or a harvest facility, and then certain fresh or frozen carcass and meat products. And then a similar rule in place for sheep, less than 12 months of age. And that's where we stand. And as you know, there's some controversy, quite a bit of controversy, about whether that should happen or not. Then a final piece I would mention is our surveillance, BSE surveillance. We started out, USDA started out in June, I believe. And they are now at nearly 210,000 samples, all of which are negative. And their original goal was, they stated, if we got to 210,000 samples, all negative, we could be 95% certain that if BSE existed in this country, it would be less than 1 per 10 million head of cattle. So that's roughly 5 head of cattle. If we're looking at 45 million head of adult cattle in this country. So we're looking at less than 5 head of cattle that they're looking at. And we are there. We're at 210,000. Their goal is to go on to 268 or 270,000. And then they'll increase the confidence interval to 99%. So that's the goal of the country. And it looks very positive. As you know, we've had a couple of interesting alarms set up where they said, well, here's this suspect, and lots of speculation, tremendous speculation about whether it was positive or not, particularly the last one. But so far, they're all negative. Okay?
Yeah.
See, the next point that I would go to, suggestions that we were thinking about for opening the border. I think that as a state we support science-based decisions, and I think that if we can be assured that Canada is in compliance and that they're slaughtering and processing protocols are on a par with the United States. In other words, we're happy that those animals are all less than the age that they claim, and we can confine that. Those are things that I think we need to be assured of, and assured that they are in compliance with their feed ban. And all those things USDA is saying to us, too. Say, we're going to go and make sure that's happening. And I think that's probably a prudent position to have. When the borders open, it would be nice if before that occurred, we could resume trade with our Pacific Rim partners. Because when the border opens, there's going to be some impact if we don't have a trade balance. And if it opened tomorrow, we would not have that trade balance because we're not moving cattle to an export. So I'd like to see that, but that's my opinion. That's something we could strive for. So we'll see if we can't get some equilibrium there. And as I speak, there is a senator, and I'm sorry I've forgotten his name, who introduced a bill or is planning on introducing a bill that says exactly that in the United States Senate. So other people are thinking along those lines. I'm putting that, getting that par set up. Now I'm going to change topics on you and talk about West Nile virus.
Let me go back to the BSE just a second. So you're saying that really everything's taken care of at the federal level to your level of comfort, and that you think the Department of Ag is handling everything appropriately?
I think what I said was that USDA is showing us an appropriate amount of restraint right now. They're saying, let's go and finish this investigation. Let's make sure that we are seeing the same picture that we thought we saw before. And I think that's appropriate.
Thank you.
Chairman?
Yes.
I'd like to ask the doctor, please, if you can give us some ballpark figure of what the disease from Canada, how it's impacted the retail cost of beef for the people of Oregon or the people of the whole country. What has it done to the retail price?
Madam Chair and Representative Sumner, I don't have that figure. I could have thought, I didn't think of grabbing that, so I don't know. I know there was some, and we saw the price, the wholesale price of beef fluctuate with that, and we all know that currently steers and heifers are at an all-time high price, but I don't know.
Katie, can you answer that?
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, I don't have specific dollar amounts. I remember last Christmas you know, as the case just broke. You may remember then U.S. Secretary Ann Veneman claiming she was going to eat beef for Christmas dinner, and we actually saw pretty quickly after that case, even though our export borders shut down, that U.S. demand for beef increased, and the price did go up, and the price in terms of sale price for individuals selling their beef has held fairly steady, fairly high, and I know we have seen an increase in the marketplace. It may have dropped a little bit, but my guess is it's higher than what it was pre the BSE case in Washington State.
As a producer, I can tell you the higher prices.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I might add, in terms of USDA's handling of this situation, I think they're doing as good a job as can be expected. It's extremely complicated. There are divergent groups of interest on this situation. They've been as open as they can in terms of communicating with these various interest groups. There is not going to be a solution that isn't going to face controversy, and I feel very good about the way they've been handling this issue.
Good. West Nile virus.
Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley said it was.
Just a follow-up question later point, not to be addressed now, but like Representative Sumner's, I'm interested in the market share impact of all this. You know, an estimate at some point in the future of how we're going to do it, because the international market share is shifting, and like Representative Smith, I'm enjoying good beef prices right now. I'm getting ready to sell some too.
It's amazing.
But we're working in a vacuum here. And so our good fortune today, which is the first in 20 years, is likely not to hold out. And as the market share shifts, other producers in other countries are going to gobble up that market share. And this whole game is a game of market share in the end and ag products. And so at some point, not now, but in the future, you know, and then the counter to that is what suggestions we have to fix it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, Dr.
Okay. West Nile virus, second topic. As everyone knows, it came. The virus entered the state last year, late in the summer, in Malheur County, and practically stayed there. But it did move throughout the state. It moved to a wide variety of counties in the bird population and insect population. And cases of horses that we saw were pretty well scattered throughout Western Oregon and Eastern Oregon, not all counties, but we had 32 cases. There were 90 horses tested, and 32 were positive. There were, in terms of birds tested, there were 450 birds tested throughout the state. 23 of those were positive, and that gave us the picture of a balance of the virus presence in the eastern and western sections of the state, so that we probably should assume that the virus is widespread now. It didn't take long. No one was surprised and moved quickly across the state. Surveillance methods are in place, waiting for some federal dollars, so very similar pattern to last year. Birds will continue to be assayed for the presence of the virus as we go through this year, and we're already testing horses, suspect horses, at this point in time. Human cases, there were five, thank you. Three of them in Malheur County, two cases, one in Jackson County, and another case, I guess there were four in Malheur County. Three of those people were ill, had what is called West Nile fever. All of them recovered. Recovery for some people from West Nile virus is a very long and prolonged episode. These people who were affected, I was told recently, have recovered. And two of the patients were asymptomatic. They were just discovered to have been exposed to the virus. So that's where we are. I think one should expect this year an earlier warning, get going on mosquito abatement, pay attention to mosquito biting times at dawn and dusk. Use protective clothing and mosquito repellents on the human side. We're going to issue a campaign strategy to get horses vaccinated and try to cut down on that as a viable source for the virus to replicate in.
So they can vaccinate ahead before they get it as a preventive measure?
Yes, they can. Yeah. Okay. And we're recommending that get started. Now is not too soon, so we'll be pushing ahead to get horses vaccinated. There's no vaccine for humans, so we don't have that choice.
When it says that, where humans get it from the same mosquito?
Same mosquito, mm-hmm. Both the horse and the human are what is known as dead-end hosts. They don't transmit the virus, but they get it and get sick from it.
Okay. Representative Summer?
Chair Smith, yeah. Doctor, are you doing something to eradicate the carriers? Are we spending more money on vector control, for example? Are we stopping the disease in the mosquito stage? Is there any hope of doing that?
Madam Chair and Representative Sumner, I was talking with Dr. DeBess, our public health veterinarian, and they have started those conversations with the mosquito vector control areas in the state, and there are plans and conferences going on as we speak to try to mitigate the presence of the vector, of the mosquito population, through late spring and early summer. So those conversations are going forward.
Good.
And maybe we can do a follow-up near the end of when the conference is, so we can find out if there's any new information. Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just had two questions real quick for the good doctor. The case in Jackson County, your perception is it originated in Jackson County, or is there a connection to Malheur County, where a person actually has more connections to the pork shows and everything else going on between the two places? So I'm just wondering your conjecture on that.
Madam Chair and Representative Boquist, my assumption as we move through, looking at each case as it occurred, we tried to make links. We never did. Now here, for whatever reason, was an incredible nidus of infection. The vast majority of cases occurred in Malheur County, in the horse population. Well, in humans too. And I don't have an explanation for that. But no, we didn't see a connection. Could have been, but didn't see it.
And just a follow-up comment that actually goes back to the fire hearing, and the same problem is that there is no freeze and there is no snowpack. Mm-hmm. I got mosquitoes biting my posterior right now at my ranch, and I've never seen that before. And so we're going to have some serious vector problems, and
right.
Unfortunately, maybe mm-hmm. a very tough fire season because we don't have the snowpack, we don't have the freeze.
But we still have March.
Ever optimistic.
Yeah. We all need to be doing our rain dances.
Right.
That comes later. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to just touch base on one other disease and then talk about the emergency response plan, since our time is quickly coming to a close. The other disease that we're concerned about, there are a bunch, but another that I will mention, is avian influenza. Now, you know, avian influenza is the bad flu bug. If the virus gets out into the population and it is the strain of pathogenic virus, it has devastating effects in the human population. As we speak, avian influenza is causing a great deal of damage in the southeastern region of the world, Cambodia and Vietnam and Thailand. And it's there. It has been in the United States and in the North American continent last year and the year before. Human cases were minimized and the outbreaks were quickly controlled. And we recognize that significance, and we recognize the significance that a virus mutates best in a dense population, and our dense populations of birds are the commercial growers, and so we're working with commercial growers in Oregon to assist them in establishing good solid biosecurity. That's the first defense, keep the bug out, and then a surveillance system. And we're having those discussions during the next couple of weeks with the commercial poultry growers of Oregon to install an avian influenza surveillance system with the commercial growers. With non-commercial growers, not that they're insignificant, they're part of the scenario. But with them, surveillance is probably, at this point, not an option, active surveillance of sampling. But we have worked very hard in this last year to issue information materials. We placed it in feed stores and poultry purchasing stores where people can see it and get an idea of what to look for avian influenza and exotic Newcastle disease and what actions to take. And then we are just finishing a series of courses with our accredited veterinarians, our veterinarians in the Oregon Emergency Response Team, and gave them an update on signs to look for avian influenza. So that's kind of what we're up to on those pieces.
Great.
Okay.
Representative Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably a really stupid question because I have a feeling I know what you mean, but when you say surveillance, under surveillance, what is your definition of that? I mean, you know, when I think surveillance, I think video cameras, and I'm thinking,
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Surveillance, we're talking about sampling birds.
Okay.
Physically sampling birds, getting the blood sample and testing for the virus, looking for the presence of the virus through sampling techniques, sampling birds, sampling houses. And that's what we mean by surveillance.
I assume.
Thank you for that question.
Minutes,
I don't.
Yeah.
I think the video cameras are in the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, she started talking. I watched it.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay. The last piece I think is a centerpiece, at least for my brief tenure, and that is the Animal Health Division's emergency response plan. It is, we're one of the few divisions in the country to have an animal disease emergency response plan. And it's not my work. We're just putting finishing touches on my predecessors that did a lot of work to get this done. And it's designed to have a blueprint, if you would, so that if we have this catastrophic disease emergency like an agroterrorism act, like foot and mouth disease or something, we have already thought through a whole number of steps and positions, and we can sit down at the table and say, okay, here's what we're going to do, and we just begin and do it, saving incredibly valuable time and knowing ahead of time what's in front of us. The process is in draft form, probably will remain in draft form for some years to come because it should be tweaked and worked with all the time. But in its current form, we are collecting comments from all of the state agencies that we think, not know, but we think that we'll work with or want to work with in one of these incredible catastrophic emergencies. And so far we're getting wonderful comments and opening doors to conversations that just need to be had. And we have them now ahead of any emergency. It'll save all kinds of time and energy and angst at the time of an emergency. So it's kind of an exciting scenario that we're going. And then the last thing that I'll mention in response to that, or in conjunction with that, is this spring, Oregon Department of Agriculture and Animal Health is going to join with five other counties on the eastern side of the state, and we're going to do an exercise, a disease emergency response exercise. And the chosen disease is foot and mouth disease. It's going to come to Oregon, and we're going to mount all of these responses and see how they work. We're choosing to test our ability to mount the initial response. The counties are choosing to test some other aspects, recovery being one of them. So the five counties will all have some exercise that they want to test, and we're testing our ability to mobilize and get up online.
Right.
So we'll find out.
Sounds very
a necessary exercise to do.
Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, Doctor, just a quick question on the emergency response plan. If it's in a draft form, is it being coordinated with the new Department of Homeland Security and with the state police and this interval cell that's over here in the, I don't remember, whatever, the Center, Anderson Center, where's the new director? It's all being rolled up so that everybody's on the same sheet of music here?
Yes. Simple answer, that was started in motion before I came on, and we're continuing it, working with Department of Homeland Security, the Oregon-based, and operations, emergency management operations, and state police, and all of those agencies. Yes.
Great.
Very much.
I wish you the best of success compared to the federal government.
Oh, yeah. I mentioned in passing the training session that we had going with our Oregon veterinarians. We have a cadre, we're trying to build a cadre of veterinarians, accredited veterinarians in the state, that will agree to be first responders, because we can anticipate that the five of us in the office, including the federal veterinarians, are going to be completely overwhelmed within the first 24 hours. And so we're working, we have a cadre of about 60 men and women now, and hoping to double that, so that if we get one of these, we can pick up the phone or the fax machine and get trained professional help very quickly. Before, it'll take 2 days or 3 days for a big federal response, and we'll need an Oregon response, and so we're working very hard to get that done.
Sounds promising.
Yeah, it does to me too.
Yeah.
I'm kind of excited about it.
Well, when you do that springtime test, I'd be interested in visiting with you when it happens.
Certainly.
Are you going to video that at all, or are you going to?
I hadn't thought that far.
Well, I was going to say it might be something I'm going to push for the committee later on.
Okay.
Good. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, you said that the plan is being shared with state and federal agencies. What about the user groups, Farm Bureau, cattlemen, those types of folks? Are they involved in helping develop this as well?
They are, particularly at local levels, county levels. And yes, to answer.
Great.
Thank you.
Question. Is there anything you want to add, Katie?
I would just say, Madam Chair, hopefully we'll never have to actually use our emergency response plan.
Well, thank you. Yes.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. The concern I've always had, and it hasn't been one, I hope, but, you know, the wildlife populations and some of these diseases, do we do an ongoing check of deer, elk, other issues with illness, populations that are found?
Like chronic waste.
And if we find a dead animal or if there's deals, do we test those as well to find out if there are diseases in the indigenous populations that are going to be a problem to our agricultural population?
Madam Chair and Representative Roveland, I think ODF&W, I know that they do certain amounts, and they are also vigilant for large die-offs, and they're, as you know, they're working with a particular repulsive skin problem that they're seeing in deer, and they're looking constantly for chronic wasting disease. I think that we rely on local farmers and ranchers to report other unusual events, and so it may not be as complete as some people envision it being, but I think people are vigilant to animal wildlife die-offs and wildlife concerns.
And I would think that would be a question you could ask Fish and Wildlife,
yeah,
too.
But I mean, as we start looking at some of these responses, yeah, I worry about, you know, a disease getting someplace else. We think we've captured it, and it's, and then we don't have an agency that's really, that's something that they care about, and it could devastate us.
Mm-hmm.
Duly noted, huh? We all have the same fear. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we're done with talking about animal diseases. Let's move to what can be a more exciting topic, and that is some of the latest trends that we're seeing in the marketplace. We have an Ag Development and Marketing Division, which works very closely with industry and marketing Oregon products, both domestically and internationally. And one of the trends that we're seeing that we believe we really need to be active in staying in front of and helping the industry be prepared for is this notion of certification. And so Dalton Hobbs, who is our Assistant Director for Marketing, is going to give a brief overview in terms of what do we mean by certification. It's very diverse. There are numerous different kinds of certification programs. We'll give you a little flavor of that and talk a little bit about what the department itself is doing to help the industry be prepared for this topic area. So with that, Dalton.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dalton Hobbs. I serve as the Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Here today to talk about certification. And when we talk about certification, what is certification? Well, it's a means of validating product quality, condition, or increasingly processes. It's a way for buyers and sellers to come to an understanding. And meaningful certification is, in fact, a process, not just a piece of paper or, indeed, a flashy logo. Certification at retail. Consumer decision-making increasingly relies on information derived from certification. We take a look here at this cartoon that appeared in Scientific American a few months ago. It contains no peanuts, caffeine-free, made in USA. There are all kinds of certification claims and so on being made at the retail level. Meaningful certification, however, can add value to products as it addresses questions, consumer questions about product safety, the place of origin, or the method of production. Certification also occurs at the wholesale level. Currently, retailers are now requiring certification from suppliers as a condition of sale. For instance, if you want to sell potatoes to Walmart, you need to have a good agricultural practice certificate that is verified by a third-party auditing system. And this is true for Costco, Albertsons, Fred Meyer's, Safeway, etc. And these programs are usually not visible at the wholesale, at the consumer level. So these programs that the wholesale grocers are requiring of the supplier, that would be agricultural producers here in Oregon, generally operate below the radar screen. So you don't see these kind of things in play when you go into your local Walmart or Costco or Albertsons. But nonetheless, they're critical in terms of getting our product into the marketplace. And at first, certification was just about getting your foot in the door. But increasingly, however, certification can spell the difference between success and failure in major markets worldwide. Wholesale buyers are now using certification scores to differentiate along with things like price, quality, terms of delivery, etc., in terms of making the buying decisions. So certification is absolutely critical in today's world. Meaningful confusion can be confusing. There are literally dozens of certification options out there for Oregon agricultural producers. Finding the best fit is really critical to optimize the certification effectiveness. You can chase your tail on a few of these things if you're not careful. And, of course, the process can be confusing as well as time-consuming for Oregon producers. A look at just some of the certification options that are available. HACCP certification, good ag practices, good handling practices, good manufacturing practices, USDA organic, the whole ISO series, International Standards Organization, 9,000 through 16,000, GMO free, private organizations such as the Food Alliance, Europe GAP, which is necessary now for all food products sold at retail in the European Union, Salmon Safe, Nature Fresh, a proprietary system that Tesco is using in the UK, Live, low input viticulture and enology. These are just some of the options that are certification programs that Oregon agricultural producers face now. Well, what are some of the concerns around certification? Certainly cost is an issue. Are the benefits worth the expense? Getting certified can cost a lot of money. Confidence. Is the certification program meaningful as well as valid? That is there confidence in the certification program? Take a look at what happens in terms of cost. And on the left-hand side, you take a look at a certification program that doesn't have active involvement with a quality assurance program, where you've got relatively low prevention and relatively low verification costs in terms of the certification program. But you also have a much higher opportunity cost for failure, and failure can occur easier if you're not investing on the front end in terms of prevention and verification. And so at the Oregon Department of Agriculture, we tend to look at programs on the right-hand side, where you're putting your money up front in terms of prevention and verification, and so you can minimize at the back end the cost of failure when a certification program actually doesn't do its job. What happens when certification fails? Product can be rejected by a consumer. Obviously, there can be a downgrading, a loss of value to the agricultural producer. Product can be recalled. You can lose market share. And for some companies, the sun just stops coming up, and they go out of business because they have not had good certification and good verification systems in place. We only need to look to about a year ago, where you saw with a couple of meat distributors in the Portland area, where there was the absolute concern that they could have gone out of business because they simply made the simple mistake of distributing product that was not certified in terms of its status regarding BSE. And there wasn't a system in place to do that. So you can see that a couple of companies and several hundred jobs almost went out of business because of this. Confidence is another issue in terms of certification. Is there confidence in the certification process? We recently received a letter from a state which will remain nameless, and this state was kind of taking the simple way out in terms of verifying or certifying a product was GMO-free. Rather than testing it, rather than having an identity preserve program, they simply said, this is to verify that we have received documentation that this product is GMO-free. Nothing further than that, simply somebody writing a letter. And, of course, it was signed the director of marketing. And this is the kind of thing where we all get painted with this kind of brush, is if we take shortcuts in terms of certification, it becomes less and less meaningful. And we need to avoid that at all costs. What about the Oregon Department of Agriculture? Well, we have over 75 years of experience in this. ODA in the mid-20s, signed the first agreements with USDA to inspect and certify commodities for both grade and condition. This is a potato packing shed just up the road here in Brooks, where we were standing at the end of the road and putting U.S. grade number one on the potato sacks and so on. And for many years, quality and condition was really the kind of certification that the marketplace wanted, and it was really the limit or extent of what we did. In the late 70s, early 80s, ODA became very active in terms of export development, and the Oregon Department of Agriculture signed agreements with the USDA to Animal Plant Health Inspection Service to certify commodities for export. And the landmark of quality symbol was used for the first time in seed certification, as you can see in these bags of orchard grass. And through the 80s, the ODA was very involved and really leading in terms of certification programs. When the ODA was named the first certified customs laboratory by the government of Japan, and this allowed us to do pre-export testing and certification to minimize risk for our exporters, so they could take a product to our laboratory, have it tested and certified, and that would minimize to a great extent impacts of the product going through customs in Japan. This was later extended to both Korea and Taiwan and several European Union nations. And the Oregon Department of Agriculture's unique status in this regard really has created value for Oregon and created a strong reputation for equality through certification. In 2000, the ODA continued our leadership when we became the first state to issue U.S. Department of Agriculture Good Ag Practices, Good Handling Practice certificates, official secured storage identification certification followed in 2001. And this year, the Oregon Department of Agriculture will become the first state to issue EuropeGAP certificates for foods exported into the European Union. Currently, if you're shipping cherries, apples, pears, processed products to any of the major multiple retailers in the European Union, you must have a EuropeGAP certificate. Currently, no state can offer that in the United States, nor USDA. So Oregon will be well-positioned to provide important certification, particularly for cherry exporters.
Representative Berman.
Madam Chair, before you go off this slide, would you explain that I'm familiar with certification in the forest product sector,
yes,
but this is all new to me. So would you explain what's behind the GAP, GHP, what is the IP, and what is the Europe gap?
Just good question.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, thank you very much, and excuse my exuberance here and kind of assuming that everybody knows what we're talking about. Good agriculture, we'll start with GAP and GHP. Good agricultural practices are a system through which a auditor will go to a farm and will look for opportunities of food safety adulteration, of systems that are not in place to assure that the product is produced in a good fashion. That includes things like ensuring that there is adequate hand washing, that there is pesticides or kept away from final packing areas, that the land was not used for a toxic waste dump and imparting heavy metals into a root crop, for instance. And it's a whole series of, there's a matrix that is developed that the auditor works through with the producer, and then when you work through these control points, then you're able to get your good agricultural practices certification. Good handling practices are a very similar kind of certification that occur in the packing plant. So again, where an auditor will go in, take a look at the packing plant, see if there's holes in the roof where birds can fly in and do their business over the potatoes, and that there's adequate hand washing, is that people are not taking their lunch break on the packing line and smoking a cigarette there, that industrial lubricants are in fact food grade on the conveyor belts, things of that nature are used. These programs are really critical in terms of assuring a high-quality food product. And the reason that they're required by most of the major food retailers is that it lessens the risk of a foodborne illness, it lessens the risk of a product recall, and it frankly passes the liability back to the packer or the producer, so that the retailer then would have sort of plausible deniability that they could say, well, we have no idea how our consumers got sick because these products were produced under good ag practices and good handling practices, so it must be a failure there. But they're nonetheless very critical. Identity preserved IP programs are an incredibly important and valuable tool in terms of adding value to products. And you'll see a little later in the presentation how that occurs. Increasingly, people want to know where their product was produced and by whom. They want to know where their product has been stored. Has it been stored securely? Has it had access to people that could adulterate it, a terrorist, for instance? It's a very important part of the certification programs that we offer. Finally, Europe Gap is kind of a heightened version of good ag practices and good handling practices, which also requires that the producer show that the foods were produced in a socially responsible manner, that slave labor, good worker conditions were in place, that the food was also produced in an environmentally sustainable fashion, that that they were not mining aquifers to irrigate the crop or using poor soil conservation techniques, etc. So it not only ensures a good quality food product from a food safety standpoint, but it goes and it begins to take a look at some of these sort of social and environmental issues as well.
And I might add, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we actually think that Oregon producers are well positioned to take advantage of a lot of these certification programs because we do produce our crops and meeting and oftentimes exceeding standards for environmental as well as social issues. I think the big challenge right now for Oregon producers is the documentation that is needed to be in place for the auditor to then come in and review those practices. So a lot of what we would talk about would be working with the industry to get that documentation established, kind of walk them through what an audit might look like, what are the things that auditors are looking for so that they're good and ready to go and become certified in a quick and easy manner.
Representative Sumner?
Madam Chair, how do you go about certifying foods labeled organic? What in the world, what's the process to verify that there's been no insecticide or chemical fertilizer used?
Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, the U.S. Department of Agriculture over about a 10-year period developed what is known as the U.S. Organic Act. And under that, there are put in place prescriptive descriptions of organic food production. Organic certification indicates or describes a system of food production, not a end product in and of itself. So there is a prescriptive list of materials that can be used in the production of foods if they are to be labeled as organic. It was a really contentious debate because a lot of these questions were brought forward by producers, different advocacy groups, etc., in terms of exactly what is organic and what does it mean. There is a fairly good understanding in the industry right now of what organic means after we've had about 3 years now of actual operational experience. And so organic doesn't mean that the product does not have a pesticide on it. It simply means that it was produced in a way that was approved by a list of approved pesticides, most of which are non-synthetic, naturally occurring substances. But many of the organic pesticides are indeed very toxic and very effective. So it's, I think there's a bit of a misnomer that there are not insecticides in, or herbicides in organic produced products. So.
And I might add, Madam Chair, Representative Sumner, in Oregon, the Oregon Department of Agriculture does not do organic certification. It is actually done by a private nonprofit, Oregon Tilth.
Thank you.
Right. Well, continuing on, talk a little bit about adding value and how the Oregon Department of Agriculture certification program. We talked about secured storage and identity preservation programs basically can certify the product's identity throughout the distribution chain. We have a program now in the Klamath Basin where potatoes are planted, harvested, received, stored, and shipped under a U.S. Under an Oregon Department of Agriculture seal. And this system meets the future U.S. Department of Agriculture country of origin labeling if and when it is implemented for produce products. And what we have found is that the participants in this program, the packing houses that have participated in this program, have actually been able to add about $1.50 per hundredweight value to their fresh potatoes by taking the time to participate in the Oregon Department of Ag certification program. What this program does is it allows us to trace back a 10-pound sack of potatoes to the actual field that they were produced in Klamath Falls. So if there's ever any issue regarding the quality, regarding the condition or safety of product, we can trace that all the way back. And we can tell you with great deal of certainty who's had control of that product and under whose custody it's been in. To get that $1.50 per hundredweight value, it costs us about 37 cents as an agency to deliver this service to the packer. So the net return is fairly significant, well over a dollar per hundredweight additional value that they receive for that investment that the packer puts in to have that certification.
Representative Berger, have a question?
Yes, thank you. $1.50 per hundredweight, what is that in percentage? I mean, I don't know what a hundredweight is worth typically.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, to put that in perspective, a typical packing house in the Klamath Basin will produce maybe a million and a half hundredweight, that is 100-pound sacks of potatoes a year. So to the bottom line, this would mean over $1 million additional income to a packing plant in the Klamath Falls area.
Well, I was specifically interested, though, in the premium. In other words, there's a tremendous amount of expense that goes into the certification process, and I'm curious what, you know, in a percentage term, what is this premium that these backers are getting for their efforts?
This is about, Madam Chair, Representative Burley, this is about a 10% premium that they're receiving on there.
Thank you.
On there. So what are some of the next steps with our certification program? We have a program option package 400, which will continue to add value to Oregon agricultural products through new certification program development and outreach. I think, as Katie was talking about, much of the challenge with certification programs is understanding what they are, understanding how to plug into them, and understanding how to make them work in the marketplace. This POP will ensure that programs will be developed and new certification programs will be produced in anticipation of marketplace demand as we see new marketplace requests or requirements. We'll produce certification programs well in advance of that. It will mean that there will be a dedicated certification position to assist Oregon industries to plan and implement certification programs. And I think, importantly, it will continue to position the ODA worldwide as a leader in meaningful certification delivery, and I think it will continue to add value to Oregon agricultural products. So for us, in conclusion, certification is a lot more than a pretty picture, talking about a great reputation as a state. Meaningful certification programs add value, and they promote Oregon products around the world in a meaningful way. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Boquist, you had a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dalton, grab your pen, because this is too complex to answer.
Okay.
And I would, you can bring it back to me unless the committee wants to hear the answer to this at a later point, but just to set the frame, I work in international trade. I've worked in 35 or 40 countries around the world, so I might have a little bit different perspective. But I'd like you to come back with one step behind. I'd like to know the rationale and the department's rationale and how you're allocating your resources against the certification rationale. What I'm explaining here is that there are really three areas or three reasons you have certification. First is consumer fears. That's the retail. And where's our market share, so on and so forth. The second one is what we call wholesale, which is the grip is. We're talking legal liability. Everybody's covering their posterior here, and what's our effort. And then the third area is free trade obstacles. Basically, I mean, we can't impact it so much, but we're talking about countries are trying to get around the GATT or the WTO, and they're saying, you got to be certified or else we're not going to take your product. And what I'm looking for is your percentage of efforts. I mean, those are the real three reasons we do this.
Right.
And what is the department's percentage of effort in addressing those, and what is our outcome, i.e., what are we getting for our bang for our buck in your mind? And don't reinvent the wheel. This isn't new rocket science. It's, I think, behind the scenes, someone in 5 minutes in your department can kind of figure this out and then kind of let me know so I get a grasp of, are we putting our money where we ought to be putting our money? Because it comes back to my original question, which is all we would take back to my fourth question here I have, which is market share. Where are we really sitting on market share, and what's the impact when we clear out of the infectious diseases and all that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I think it would be probably mutually beneficial if we just came in and sat down and talked to you about our marketing program, what we do, how we work with the industry. Certification is just a kind of a new piece, and it's important to stress a piece of what we do overall in the agency in terms of marketing. And I also want to make clear for the record, we're not proposing with this package that the Department of Ag develop certification programs, and most importantly, that we are requiring any kind of certification programs for producers or processors. We view this as a technical assistance package for the industry. We've had various industry groups come to us and say, we would like to work with you to develop a certification program for this specific issue, and that those would be the kinds of things we would envision happening with this package. And in addition, the certification could be done by a party outside of our agency or outside state government. We're not saying we've got to be the ones that provide all the certification services. Again, it's understanding what's happening in the marketplace, helping the producer understand what's happening in the marketplace, and then helping the producer take advantage of that in whichever way works best for the producer.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I'm not beating you up.
No,
I'm on your team, okay? What I guess what I'm driving at is that you can really, in the agriculture community, we as a whole can alleviate consumer fears. Mm-hmm. When it comes to legal liabilities, that's really out there. I mean, we have input, but that's outside of this committee's purview and outside of your purview. But I'm looking for your input of, okay, how much of this is legal liability? If it's legal liability, then that's a broad scoping where we get the ag community on board the legal liability issue. And we solve that in a different forum. And, of course, obviously, free trade goes back to the market share here. And so what I'm looking for is ammunition.
Great.
To resolve really the mid-class one, which is, what is the legal liability issue? Should we not be spending more time alleviating consumer fears so we can retail market where we have a higher rate of return on our product? Versus the issue of, are we dealing with world travelers? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think that's a good suggestion to follow up. Representative Burley.
And I'd just like to follow up on that, too, because and my question earlier about, you know, what is this in a percentage of premium is that, you know, my experience, albeit rather limited, is that there's not an awful lot of premium in these certification programs, but, you know, without having the certification, you've got market barriers that you're facing. If I understand the Europe gap, for example, that's a classic example. Mm-hmm. So if I may add to Representative Boquist's request, I would be interested in seeing some of those costs. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, some of these things are just, they're just, you know, costs that we have to incur, and we're not getting any premium for it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's, you know, that's passed on to the producers, and it's passed on to the consumers.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I might add, you're absolutely right. I think a classic case that you're speaking to is what's happening right now in our nursery industry in dealing with sudden oak death. And we have worked with the industry to develop a certification program that isn't necessarily returning an increased dollar value to the producer, but it's keeping them in the marketplace.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
You very much. Good information.
Okay.
All right.
That's all we had on certification.
Did you have anything you wanted to add? Or?
No, I'm ready to go on to the next topic
all
unless
right.
there are other questions.
We are too. Thank you.
Okay. The next area that we'd like to focus on briefly is bring up one of our Board of Agriculture members, Pat Dudley, who with her husband and brother and sister-in-law own and operate Bethel Heights Winery here in West Salem. And the chair was very involved in a piece of legislation last session trying to focus more efforts around buying local. And the Board of Ag stepped up and kind of took on this topic in the interim. Pat Dudley was the chair of our work group that has been working on this effort. It's by no means finished, but we'd like to have Pat come up and talk you through a little bit what we've been doing in terms of the area of trying to increase local purchase of Oregon products. So
great, thank you. You want to come forward? And committee, I brought this up just as an update because you weren't on the interim or on the representative buyer was. Just to kind of give us an update on what you've been doing and what you've discovered, that'd be great.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I really thought we would have reported out on this a long time ago. I'm new to this system. I was appointed to the board in 2002, and my first meeting I said we were hearing presentations about two bills that were going in front of the legislature to introduce a state purchase preference policy for Oregon products. And it sounded interesting, and I foolishly raised my hand and was appointed to chair a committee to look into the matter. And I thought this was going to be easy. Well, we're still at it. And I'm beginning to get used to the snail's pace. I'm sure we'll still be waiting to hear the final report long after my term has expired, but it's still an interesting topic. Okay, I'm going to try to quickly give you a little history of what we did. We looked at both of these pieces of legislation, which in retrospect, I'm sorry, were so closely focused on a state purchase preference policy because it's such a very narrow way of looking at increasing the purchase of locally produced products. But in any case, that is where we started. And we had an initial meeting. Representative Smith was really the instigator of this, of a large work group involving many different groups and interests in agriculture and related industries, to sort of talk about what a state purchase preference policy might mean. And what we found was a lot of interest in increasing purchase of locally produced products, but it was very amorphous because many people are more interested in having that be addressed to the consumers in the state rather than just the state purchasing process itself. And the more we looked into this, we realized that state purchasing of food products is very minimal, and it's really primarily for corrections. The state doesn't purchase for the schools, even as they do in Washington, where they have a state purchase preference policy, which they're quite proud of. But if you're just going to purchase for corrections, you're looking at a budget per person per day of $3.71 or something like that. So it's not going to ever, even if they bought all Oregon products, which they can't do because it's so price sensitive, it's never going to have a major impact on Oregon agriculture. If you really wanted to have an impact in terms of the question of keeping Oregon agriculture viable, you'd want to address the consumer public more than you want to just narrowly focus on a state purchase preference. But in any case, that was where we started, and we were, after this large work group met and said, wonderful, wonderful, of course everybody wants to increase the purchase of locally grown products. Nobody had any objections, no problems with that. Go forward. We had a little fact-finding group, and that's really what we've been doing for the last 2 years since this all started. It's been myself and a staff person from Dalton's staff, Laura Barton, actually, and two people from the Department of Administrative Services, and I think two of the smartest people in state government that I've ever met, actually. Really very helpful. It was Dugan Petty and Dan Clem. And we set about to do a series of interviews with local producers and distributors of food. We quickly got to the point where if you're just talking about fresh produce, that's something that's readily identifiable, and it's easy. There are a lot of people that are supporting the increased purchase of fresh Oregon produce. State nutritionists, people in the schools, farmers markets, there's a lot behind that. But when we looked at just the Washington program in their state purchase preference policy, only 20% of their purchases were fresh produce, and of course most of what people buy is processed in one form or another. So we were really interested in going beyond the fresh produce and just exploring what it would mean to try to identify locally grown products that are processed products and make that identification available to whatever, the state or the consumer or the retailer who wants to purchase local products. So we went and interviewed two local processors, local meaning Oregon, Trailblazer Foods and Truett Brothers, and we interviewed then three distributors, Food Services of America, Sysco, and we interviewed NORPAC. It was three producers. And we had very interesting conversations with all of those. Very interesting. We learned two main things, at least I did. I think the real revelations were, first of all, that these processors and distributors have a way of identifying, as we just learned from Dalton, because of all the food safety protocols in place nowadays, you can figure out, going into anybody's database, where every ingredient in a can of soup comes from at any given moment. They can do that. The information is all in their database. It's not necessarily on a label in any form. I mean, it can be on a label in some form, like on those UPC codes or those barcodes that can tell you a lot of information if you have the system to understand it. But there's very little that's put on a label that a consumer can recognize about what percent is grown where. But in any case, the information is all there. And if they had an incentive to spit it back out in some kind of form or other, it wouldn't be that difficult. It's a question of the incentive. That was one thing we learned. The second thing was that all of these distributors all of them, are very conscious of a trend in the market towards people wanting to know, as Dalton just said, where their food comes from, and wanting to, in fact, support local if they can figure out what that means. So this, we got this sort of unanimous, you know, this is great stuff, everybody wants to know it. Sysco, which is the largest food distributor in the country, I believe, has a brochure that they just, Sysco of Portland, it's a very nice brochure that says 38% of our suppliers are local, and it lists them, and it doesn't tell you exactly how they determined that they were local, but they have their answers. And then Food Services of America has a special place on their website where you can go to identify locally grown products. So there's a lot of interest in this in the marketplace, and from everything we're hearing, it's increasing all the time. And there's where I market my product, which is wine, sort of on the specialty crop value added end of the spectrum, there's a huge interest in it in markets not only in this country but around the world. They want a face to go with the product. And that seems to be the way marketing the high-value specialty crops is really going forward now, which, of course, is one of our most successful niches now in terms of economic development and agriculture. So that was all very positive. The last thing that happened here, after we got done with all those interviews, we were starting to put it together in a system. I'm afraid I've gone beyond my 5 minutes. Okay. Dugan Petty, who, as I say, is one of the smartest people in state government that I've ever met, had produced this wonderful flow chart. You know, it was complex. I mean, let's not say this is going to be easy, but how that we could develop a system of identifying an auditable list of Oregon producers according to some definition that we would agree on, what we mean by local, 50%, 70% of the product in the can is locally grown, whatever we decided, they could go through this process of doing an identification and then publishing a list that would be, for the purposes of state purchases, used to increase the purchase of locally produced products, but also could be published for the use of anybody else who cared to use it in the private sector. And there's every day something in the news about this cafeteria in the university or that food service wants to have all local products. Well, you could hand them this and say, here you go. Go buy them. So this was all in the works, and Dugan was all set to write us a white paper that would be floated to our work group. We need to reconvene that and go back to that. And well, then Dugan got promoted to a whole new area. It's special services or something like that. He still has his cell phone, so I was able to reach him, and he said, yeah, I know, Pat, I still owe you a white paper, but now they're hearing Measure 37 claims in special, so it's going to be a while before we get back to this, unfortunately. And Dan Clem was also promoted. So our whole work group is in. Laura's off. Her real position is export marketing. So this back burner project of mine has suddenly gotten even further relegated into the freezer, as far as I can tell, as far as state purchasing is concerned. But nonetheless, we started looking at another approach to this just very recently. The last thing Laura did for me before she was sent off on another mission in some foreign country was to find me a list of websites of other state programs that are not necessarily state purchase preference programs for state agencies, but they're marketing programs to increase the purchase of locally grown products for consumers, like the Heart of Washington or Oregon, Ohio Proud. There are at least 13 states' websites that Laura provided for me, which I've looked at two of now because I actually also have a full-time job. So I haven't gotten through the whole list. But those are really interesting other kinds of models, where instead of starting with a state purchase preference program, you start with something where you have what's basically a marketing program, sort of like Brand Oregon, only not not exactly, but more tending in that direction. The Ohio program, which is one that I actually looked through their whole website and read, it's a fee-based program. Suppliers have to register their products. They sign an affidavit or something. They swear that each thing is more than 50% grown in the state. I haven't had a chance to follow up and say, is this audited? I mean, there are a lot of questions. We could do a lot of research here if we had the time to do it. 2 years from now, if you're all still here and I'm still here, maybe we'll have something to tell you about what we might want to recommend that Oregon do. Every state is a little different, and as I keep being told very firmly by our marketing department, we are a net export state. We don't want to do anything that's going to interfere with reciprocity. If we can't expect Oregonians to buy all our products. We export a whole lot more than we consume locally. All this is true, but it's also true that Oregon, brand Oregon, may be something valuable to people outside the state of Oregon, again, if it's associated with all kinds of qualities that people are looking for in products, like the high standards that we have here, environmental, social, and just food safety. So there may be a way of going at this that would be more to address the market and less to address state bureaucracies, because that may be the slow approach to this. So that's what we're doing now. I think if, to the extent we're creeping forward with this, we will be looking at other states, and I hope we can come up sooner or later with a good recommendation for a good program for Oregon, because our board would very much like to be in a position to make good policy recommendations in the future. It's one of the things we hope to do, which is why we're not hastening to make a recommendation before we have enough information. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Pat. Thank you for all your work on this. There's no easy issue, is there?
I haven't found one yet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. The Washington education, where, you know, the food program that they have in Washington, did you look at that very seriously and percentages of product that increased?
I think we don't know yet. When we had our work group meeting in July of 2003, they had just started with this program, and they weren't really able to provide any measurement, and that would be something we'd want to ask about all these programs. Do they have any way of measuring yet what impact that's had? And I'm sorry, I don't know the answer for Washington or anywhere else yet, but would like to find out. If we had any more staff or budget, we could get right on this.
Representative Bocas?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to go just 30 seconds or less on the, you said people, wholesalers and purchasers, so on and so forth, want to put a face with the product. I think what you're really saying is they want to see you. If it's your product, they want to see you. Not all the fancy slogans. They want you to come over and talk to them, and they want to understand that you're the human being that's behind this product and get a feel for your personality. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Representative Boquist, it's very much so, especially the kind of product I have to sell. I'm not sure that works with everything, but I've seen pictures of Japanese grocery stores where they have the picture of the farmer next to the whatever it is they're selling there. I think this is, yes, the answer is yes. That's the short answer.
And I might add, Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, in our marketing efforts, we've used that notion. Let me give you one example. We have a producer up in Washington County, Roy Malinsky, who grows blueberries and exports fresh blueberries into the Japanese market. And we have worked with retailers over there setting up a blueberry display where we have a picture of Mr. Malinsky and his family on the display. Underneath that, our good agricultural practices seal with the ODA stamp on that. And just kind of a humorous bent to this story, blueberries are known for, among other things, their quality to help your eyesight. And Mr. Malinsky wears glasses, but in the picture that we took of him and his family, he took his glasses off.
That's
With that, I think what we wanted to do was shift, since Pat had mentioned in her presentation, why don't you step for this, the notion of the market side of identifying local products, and talk about the Brand Oregon efforts in the state and how agriculture has participated in those marketing efforts, really kind of the first initial group that we saw using the New Brand Oregon effort. And as you may remember, as I mentioned when I appeared before the committee before, in particular talking about the California Grown ad campaign in terms of marketing California products and the fact that they spent $32 million on their California Grown program here in the state of Oregon for this current biennium. The state resources going into the Brand Oregon effort are a little over $400,000. So we are challenged by the amount of resource we have to contribute to a marketing program, but I think you'll be impressed by what's happened, at least with the ag industry.
Thank you, Katie, and members of the committee. Wanted to give a little update on where we're at with the Seafood Oregon and the Brand Oregon program, starting by discussing what our marketing plan targets are. Wild Oregon seafood is the basis for a healthful, unique selling proposition that naturally fits Oregon's image. It's one of the things that we really have an advantage in terms of marketing our seafood products, and indeed a lot of our products here in Oregon, in terms of what our image is and the wild concept. We wanted to investigate how to secure brand loyalty in the retail market. That is, can we create a brand for Oregon seafood products, and how do we secure brand loyalty? To do this, we targeted regional retail chains and limited geographic regions of larger retail chains, since sufficient quantities of seafood from Oregon are not always available. We don't produce a lot of salmon. It's really good salmon, but we don't produce a lot of it compared to, say, the Norwegians or the British Columbians or the Scots or any of the other farm groups around. But so we don't have the resources to cover the entire world or planet, but we wanted to take a look at limited geographic regions for our program. And we found that since seafood, more than 50% of all seafood is consumed outside of the home in food service establishments, we wanted to target food service operations, particularly white tablecloth, because that's where the money is for higher value seafood products like Dungeness crab and troll Chinook salmon. And we also wanted to target ethnic groups, markets, particularly the Hispanic market, which spends much higher percentages of disposable income on food and particularly seafood. There's a rich tradition within the Hispanic market of consuming seafood much more than, say, other parts of the United States, where U.S. seafood per capita consumption is somewhere around 15 pounds per capita. In certain Hispanic segments, it's as much as 30 pounds, or almost double of what the seafood consumption is. We had never targeted Hispanic markets before in any of our Commodity Commission programs. Seafood Oregon got its start about this time last year with the Oregon Wild Seafood Program. Director Koba here is seen kicking this off up at Zupan Market in Portland. And the Brand Oregon program presented really a significant promotional opportunity for our Oregon commodity commissions, the four seafood commissions, albacore, tuna, Dungeness crab, salmon, and trawl, to work together collaboratively to promote seafood. Clear Channel donated to the Brand Oregon program over $300,000 worth of outdoor, that is, billboards and radio time. And this was matched with another $70,000 from the Commodity Commissions for the cost of production of the billboards, that is, the printing of the billboards and the making of the radio spots. And our own Wyden and Kennedy, the famous ad agency in Portland, offered discounted creative services and came up with the Oregon Wild Seafood logo that you see here in the background in the banner, and also point-of-sale material to identify at the marketplace, such as here, that the product was indeed produced in Oregon. Targeted markets for the rollout of this were in the Portland and Salem areas. We started with salmon. We moved to shrimp and then to albacore. And crab started in December, and sole actually will start next month. Early results of this program are very promising. Same-store sales increased year-on-year 70% for salmon at Zupan's Market in Portland. In absolute terms, this is not a whole lot in terms of tonnage. We're not talking about millions of hundreds of hundredweight like we are in potatoes. We're talking about hundreds of pounds, but when you're talking about a product that sells for $14 to $18 per pound, you don't make it up on the volume, you make it up on the value. And that's really what this is all about for us in the Wild Oregon campaign. One of the things, though, we do need to develop and continue to work on, certainly echoing what Representative Boquist was bringing up, is how to develop meaningful measures to measure program effectiveness. That is, how do we know that these promotion programs are truly adding the value? Is there a cost benefit there? We invested over $300,000 of both earned media as well as actual cost. Did it inure that or greater benefit to Oregon's economy as a result? Those are the kinds of measurements that we need to get better at doing, and we will do so as the program unfolds. You will see this month Wild Oregon Soul. If you'll notice that the logo has changed from Oregon Wild to Wild Oregon. We will be doing billboards and radios with Wild Oregon Soul. We will be doing point-of-sale material. And this will set the stage for additional promotion mm-hmm. by our four commodity commissions working together at the Boston Seafood Show in March, as well as the March opening of the 2005 Oregon Troll Salmon season. And based on some concerns that one environmental organization had, Wieden & Kennedy is now underway developing some new creative that will be available to the Seafood Commissions to use in the future. So we're excited about this program. The commissions, for the first time, all four of them worked together. We're able to mount a considerable promotion program to identify the product at the point of sale as being Oregon. Anecdotal evidence indicates that sales increased, particularly for the Oregon products in the stores that participated. And there was very good evidence that prices were to a certain extent, impacted at the boat level. Salmon fishermen, for instance, had a season average price last year of well over $3 per pound. The year before, salmon fishermen received about $1.25 a pound at the boat level for their fish. So probably in excess of $5 million additional dollars were created at the boat level because of these increased prices. And not all related to Brand Oregon and marketing, but certainly the buzz around identifying and labeling a product as produced in Oregon, that it's a wild product, certainly had a great deal to add to that value. And that means a lot of new F-150 pickups down on the coast and a lot of jobs. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions about the program.
Are you partial to F-150?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not, but the fishermen down there seem to be.
Apparently. Well, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Chair. We begun, you know, the marketing for the salmon was really Portland and Salem. That was the big push. Have we looked at other markets, i.e. Seattle, San Francisco? And I know we're competing with the big California money that they're trying to do, but I, you know, in being from Washington and having family in California, I think, and we've talked to people on the coast, I think there is a big market there for Oregon stuff, because we do have on the West Coast singular identification with respect to this market in particular. You know, Washington, British Columbia, the Atlantic salmon issues, a whole lot of other kinds of things in the stuff they're doing. Gives us a market, I believe, and I hope that we're looking beyond just that market if it pays off. And again, I share with Representative Boquist in the idea that we need to make sure that there is a real value that's coming to it as mm-hmm. opposed to what we're spending.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, what's interesting about the West Coast is that great troll king Chinook salmon are produced in California and great king troll Chinook salmon are produced in Washington State along with Oregon. In Washington, the consumers like to buy locally. They like to buy Washington wild salmon. And in California, the California Salmon Commission has done a wonderful job in branding their product, very similar to what we've done. And they also received record high prices at the boat level. level and at retail for their salmon. Instead of looking at markets on the West Coast, we've instead looked at markets in the Midwest. And Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, Denver are all the next target that we're looking at because there's not a whole lot of competition there. So that's where we're looking.
That's really positive.
Yeah.
And it's getting it there.
Right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Good presentation.
Madam Chair, the last thing we wanted to touch on was renewable energy, and I believe your committee had a whole hearing devoted to renewable energy opportunities. But I just wanted to bring to your attention, our department has been involved in the state's efforts around renewable energy because obviously the potential source for a lot of the fuel that would go into this is agriculture. So I wanted to have Brent Searle come up, who is a special assistant to me, and gets every odd job in the agency and has collected the renewable energy responsibilities now. And I just wanted to have him speak to you from the perspective of the opportunities for Oregon agriculture around renewable energy. I also wanted to bring to your attention, you remember we talked about a budget package on certification that's been included in our budget. There's also a position in that request for a full-time a person in our agency devoted to renewable energy opportunities. So we just wanted to bring that to your attention and talk about what that person would be doing if we were successful with that package. So with that, I'll turn it over to Brent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brent Searle, Department of Agriculture. I know you've heard quite a bit about this last week, so I'll try not to be repetitive of what you've heard. From our department's perspective, we've witnessed a great deal of interest in the whole renewable energy field in the last 2 or 3 years. And several reasons for that. I think you've probably heard some about the federal level things going on there. The 2002 Farm Bill, for the first time in history, had an energy title in there with new incentives and such, so that spurred some of this. Also, the 2004 Jobs Bill that was just passed and signed has some excise tax exemptions for the first time for biodiesel, continuation for ethanol. So those things are going on there. And then the EPA mandate on low sulfur diesel, which is being phased in starting in 2006, is viewed as another opportunity because that removal of sulfur requires the replacement with some lubricity agent, and a 2% blend of biodiesel, you probably heard that figure, would fill that requirement on the lubricity side. And so a lot of the interest is shooting for 2006 in that new market that's going to be opening up there. And so with those developments, with the price of petroleum fuels where they are and the prospects of them staying in that range from all indications, a lot of interest going, and that's created a need for our department to get involved in some of these issues, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But also, from an economic development point of view, we certainly see this as something that's critical to the industry. And just an example here, in wind energy, one of the growers that's a wee grower involved in some of the wind tower projects in terms of leasing land for that over in eastern Oregon, 16 towers, they occupy about a half acre each in their footage, so a total of 8 acres. And on average in Oregon here, it's about $2,000 per tower. Rental payment to the grower. So for those towers there, that grower is receiving about $32,000 a year, from which if it were in wheat would be less than $1,000. So significant difference there in terms of economics. And the county also is reaping quite a bit of benefit in terms of their county tax base. That increase for Sherman County, it was a 10% increase in their tax revenues from that one project. So they're certainly interested in a local level of increasing more wind power there from many aspects. And likewise, so we'll see with these other things, many of them, because of the whole renewable aspect of these, the tide of the resource, many of them are tied to agriculture, the land base, and et cetera. So the interest is there. We're seeing it in biofuels, crop production potential in dairy digesters, the wind, and other areas. So we have been collaborating closely with the Department of Energy. As Director indicated, I've been trying to keep our foot in the water a bit on this to the extent we can help the industry. And mostly we've been involved in some educational efforts with other agencies and entities, trying to acquaint growers with these developments, what's going on, what kind of incentives, federal grants and such are available. I think we are trying to play a critical role in linking growers and grower organizations with the business interests here, for example, in the development of biodiesel and ethanol. The companies that are on the processing side of this are not necessarily familiar with the production of crops, and so it's critical to get those that link there. In the past, one of the challenges we've had is this chicken-egg issue, where it's partly been an economic issue, but also because the developers on the processing side didn't want to commit large dollars to build the infrastructure facilities without having a committed feedstock production. But the growers were reluctant to put in a lot of acreage of production until they saw demand for the product. So that was a chicken-egg dilemma that we've struggled with for many years. But I think we're seeing a lot of those issues being addressed, and the economics coming into play right now are exciting. There are at least, you may have heard these numbers, so I don't want to be repetitive, but on the neighborhood of 8 biodiesel proposals of various sizes in Oregon, ranging from less than 1 million gallons to over 75 million gallons, which is significant. And so this could potentially represent hundreds of thousands, if not over 1 million acres, in prospective rotational crop opportunities for Oregon growers. So further, our role has been in identifying and helping growers familiarize themselves with the financial and grant resources that may be available at both the state level and the federal level. We put a lot of this information on our website, and we've tried to provide meaningful input on policy and legislative concepts through the State Renewable Energy Action Plan that the Department of Energy is taking the lead on. And as Director indicated, we, again, this is a new arena, and we haven't had a lot of resources to put into it and have a proposal in our budget package, and I put on the backside there, I won't go through this, but just an idea, we're just scratching the surface in this. The potential is huge, and the involvement of the department, I think, is critical because, again, these are largely rural-based projects, and so it's essential to help the industry understand what they are and provide technical assistance and to make these links that are important. So I'll stop there, and if you have questions, I'll try to respond.
Thank you. I think you just touched the tip of the iceberg on this issue. Any questions for Mr. Searle? I guess you did a great job. Thank you very much. Are there any other issues that you...
Madam Chair, that I think is more than enough for one day, unless there are additional questions that members might have.
Any questions for the director? Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you for all of you for taking the time to be here today. With that, we are adjourned. Stay tuned.